It was my first day as a case manager. I was hired at Community Counseling Centers of Chicago, and as a case manager, my responsibility was to manage a caseload, a list, a group of mentally ill people, people with many disorders, behavioral, psychological, etc., all the above, and all of the other things that go with it, including the fact that many cannot live on their own. They need support. They need help. The clients that I was to manage as a case manager were living in the community, but they needed case management services. This is in the city of Chicago, and you have a lot of different dynamics going on all the time, of course, in a big city. But my first day, a colleague of mine who was there to walk me through my first day and my second day and first week so I can get on my feet, brought me to a discharge meeting. Now, this discharge meeting was very interesting. It was interesting because I wasn't sure what to expect. And, of course, being on the first day, you never know what to expect. So we arrived at the psychiatric hospital on the north side of Chicago. And as we came in, we sat down and we said, okay. And then we sat with the person, I don't remember his name. This was 27 years ago. And we were talking more with him, and the reason why he was being discharged from case management services from community counseling centers of Chicago was the fact that he had some very definite ideas about what was going on in his world, in his reality. So we were going over a checklist. We got to talking with him. And then at some point, Tom, my colleague, who was his case manager of this gentleman, asked him point blank, now, who told you that sharks were going to come out of Lake Michigan and get you? Well, the soap did. And the soap was telling you that the sharks are going to come out of Lake Michigan to get you. Yeah, they really, it did. Okay, and we then concluded the discharge process and went on from there. Now, it may seem pretty funny to you, and it was kind of, honestly, it was quite humorous to me and funny, and how in the world does a person think that sharks are coming out of fresh water, a fresh body of water, Lake Michigan, here in the Midwest of the United States of America, and come after a person? Makes no sense. And obviously this gentleman had a lot of issues with his mental health. He was mentally ill. He was on a lot of different medications. But also what was in his case profile was that he had a lot of other addictions and other compulsive issues. Addiction. Psychology. The psychological effects of addiction. That's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to walk through some of the things we've walked through before just to kind of get our grounding here when we look at the psychological effects. But in general, we're going to look at just what is involved in the behavior of an addict. And what we often find is that with addicts is that, and of course, if you're watching, we all have something. We all have something we get addicted to. Maybe it's something small, like some obsessive compulsive behavior you have, or something else. You got to have a cup of water in a red cup, and that's that. And we've touched on these things before. But what's interesting with the psychology is that as an addict, which we've talked about before, gets attached to that thing, that person, place, or thing, They want what they want now. It's got to be now. If I don't have it now, there's a sense of urgency. Urgency. Oh, I'm around Grandma. Ooh, she reminds me of what other people think of me. And oh, I feel then bad, and therefore that leads to anger that's turned inward, which is depression, and therefore I want to go drink. Or I want to smoke crack cocaine, because that will make me feel better. The brain, the mind, powerful. Great effects and affects when it comes to what happens as we get exposed to different people, places, and things, as we think we need something when we don't. And well, the mind and the heart are affected by the whole chemistry of addiction. So let's walk through this. And we'll nuance, again, many of these things that come up when it comes to I want what I want when I want it, the urgency, the different effects of where if I don't have it, I cannot function, and therefore I am not well, and I might as well just die. And as I said before, when it comes to people caught in addiction, that's active addiction, they either will find themselves in jail, in an institution, like the gentleman I talked about who thought the sharks are coming out of Lake Michigan, or death. Jails, institutions, or death, eventually. And yes, as a person uses a substance, uses, even in behavior, it affects the mind, how the person thinks, behaves, and also carries on with life. Okay, here we go. Facts about addiction and treatment. Treatment. And we, of course, looked at what addiction is. We said, okay, yeah, it's a brain disease, but with biological and psychological and social components. And does treatment work with this? It can. It does. But it becomes very difficult because many of our people who we work with, and as I work with people in community recovery, they come and then they leave. They come and they leave. And they go to the psychiatric hospital or the rehab, and it's in and it's out. And then they mess up, they relapse, they go back in for another 45 days or maybe a couple months. Not enough. It's baffling. Cost effective, yes, in the long run, as far as treatment. Of course, looking at the disease model again, with biological, sociological, and psychological components. Here's a case study. 37-year-old man lives with his wife, quote-unquote, and two kids. Often, it's cohabitation. They may be married, they may not be married. Inner city, dropped out of 10th grade, skilled worker. His parents are substance abusers. This is a common theme. If we looked at this before, 10 years heroin use, IV, and intranasal cocaine and alcohol. One treatment, detox, 6 years ago with this gentleman. 15 years incarcerated since age 15. He was busted for possession, intent to distribute, armed robbery, third degree sexual offense. He wants help. I can't keep living this way. Yes, I need the coffee. I need the water. It's got to be the red cup. It's got to be the white cup with the coffee decorations on it. And if I don't have it, I can't go on. I must smoke the joint. I must get into the whole behavior of prostitution. My brain tells me I need to do this. But you come to a point where you can't keep living that way. It goes back to the story that I told you about in the previous video about this couple of whom the dad signed off his daughter and said, here, take her because I'm in a place where I can't keep going on. I need the cocaine and I'm making good money and mom's in jail. Addicts hopefully, and this is their salvation, psychologically come to a place of surrender. And look at the steps of recovery. The first step is, I admit that I'm powerless over my addictions and my compulsive behaviors, and my life has become unmanageable. So mentally, psychologically, an addict has to come to that place of complete and utter surrender where they can't go on at all as their salvation. As a first step towards God, Christ, and salvation spiritually, and it's all spiritual, but also then psychologically, salvation, and salvation sociologically and socially, and also physically. To stop, to then abstain from using the substance of choice, or stop from the behavior of choice, so that it won't become self-destructive. Well, the nature of substance abuse, I love this cartoon. If you can see it here on the screen, the caption is, with these two guys on the street, one guy is drinking coffee, the other guy is, of course, guzzling his booze. That is not one of the seven habits of highly effective people. And it isn't. The three C's of addiction: control, early social recreational use. So psychologically, we're telling ourselves, this is okay. This is fine. I can have a cup of coffee. I can have a glass of wine. I can have that beer. And it's okay because everybody is doing it. True. Control. Eventual loss, though, of emotional and behavioral control as the person slides into the need for that beer, or the wine, or the other alcoholic beverage, or that smoking of the substance. They will lose emotional and behavioral control. I gotta have it. I gotta have it now. I gotta have it all the time. Morning, noon, day, night. But at first, seems okay. Because then there are cognitive distortions. Denial. Oh, it's only one. Oh, maybe one more. And the person convinces himself or herself that's going to be okay, and I don't have a problem. Or if I do have a problem, I'll quit tomorrow. So they think. Tolerance, withdrawal. Tolerance and withdrawal with as we look at addiction and control. Tolerance, the body begins to tolerate it. And we looked at the physiology of this before, as well as the withdrawal. That if a person quits cold turkey, the withdrawal can be severe. Compulsion. So from control to compulsion, the second C of addiction. Drug-seeking activities. Craving it. Like I said, got to have it. Go after it. Something draws you. It's kind of like the person who after work says, I have to eat. I deserve it. I need to self-indulge. And I will go to that McDonald's. Go through the drive-thru because, it's that long drive back home, even though it's 10 minutes. I've got to go to McDonald's. I need my Diet Coke. I've got to eat my cheeseburger. And it draws you the moment you get in the car after a long day at the office or the factory or whatever. Got to have it. So maybe it isn't cocaine. Maybe it's cheeseburgers. Continued use despite adverse consequences. Okay, let's say it's cheeseburgers. How's the waistline? What does the scale say? How's the blood pressure? Cholesterol going up? And yet the compulsion says, the body says, I got to seek this out. I need the 10th cup of coffee for the day. Adverse consequences. I got the jitters. I can't go to sleep. Now I'll admit it. I love coffee, me, myself. And just the other night, I thought, I've got some other papers to grade for another class I'm teaching. And I know it's 10 o'clock at night. I'll make a pot of coffee, at least have a good 2 mugs of coffee. It will be okay. Sure enough, by 4 in the morning, I was up. I could not sleep. I was feeling the jitters. It's hard to get back to sleep, and I was tired the next day. Should have known. Should have known. When it comes to caffeine, the drug of choice that everybody says is okay. Well, consequences. Then chronicity. Time. Natural history of multiple relapses preceding stable recovery. Again, natural history of multiple relapses preceding stable recovery. Sometimes it takes 5 times, 10 times before coming out of that tolerance, that coming out of the denial where we're saying it's okay and we do abstain from that coffee or from the cheeseburger or from the cocaine and we're doing okay for another day clean. The time is 1 moment at a time, one day at a time, as we say in recovery. But then, oh, it looks so good to go through that drive-thru. Oh, there, I know that guy walking down the street. I met him at the dope house. Yeah. Another Starbucks on the driving by. I think I'll go. Gotta have it. And then we fall. Because whatever is the root issue of the addiction, family of origin issues, self-esteem issues, pain, shame, hurt, and we think that drug of choice is going to make us feel better. If I only eat comfort food, that cheeseburger, I'll feel better. And then your heart and your blood pressure and the rest of your body revolts. Chronicity. And sometimes we have to fall in order to get up. And every setback is a setup for a comeback, we say in recovery. It takes time to get through these things of addiction when it comes to the mind and the heart and the behavior. And also, with again, years of sobriety, relapse is still a reality. Well, see, the issue is not necessarily the drug. The issue is about the root issue, again, family of origin, but also the thing of needing control. Do I have control over my life? So you immediately see that this is a spiritual issue, psychologically. Because I think I can be in control of what I do and also what I say and also over the consequences I may incur for using my drug of choice. But see, addicts seek control, not abstinence. Abstinence, again, is one of our goals in overcoming and breaking the addiction cycle, but it's not necessarily the issue. The issue is about control. If I can have just one, then I'll be normal, says the guy here in the cartoon. Just like my friends. Just like my people, the friends, perhaps that is, who are sober all the time or covered up pretty well. Control. Risk factors. Genetics. I know this personally because my parents over the years have said, you know, your great uncle who was an alcoholic, we've been concerned about you, Mark. Concerned that you will then pick up the drink, that you will seek out that drug of choice and get caught and also go down the spiral of addiction and be in trouble. Thankfully, by God's grace, I haven't. But I still have my codependency issues. I still have my caffeine issues. I still have my my moments. We all do. But genetics is a real deal. Many of the people that we work with in recovery, they in fact have moms and dads who have struggled with this, just like the 37-year-old man we looked at a minute ago in the case study. The genetics do not lie. It does get passed on from generation to generation, primarily, says the research, through parents to children. And of course, as we grow up, we say, my goodness, I'm becoming like my dad. My goodness, I'm becoming like my mother. Oh boy, I married someone like my dad, she says. Wow, she's just like mom, he says. It's true. And looking at the earlier age of onset, when it comes to addiction, I have unfortunately been in company with families where he or she said, yeah, dad used to give me alcohol when I was 3 years old. Or dad used to put a little alcohol in my baby formula. Or whatever. Because in his mind, again, like the sharks coming out of Lake Michigan, in his mind, that is going to be okay, and it's not okay. Yeah, it'll help the tooth pain. You know, when you're teething as an infant becoming a toddler, and you've got the teeth coming through, and the addict says, yeah, this makes me feel good. Put a little bit of that in the dish or in the bottle. The sooner that the kid is exposed to it, the sooner that the child is ingesting it, the sooner it will be that he or she will engage. And see, and the body then will then need that drug of choice. Of course, if we get childhood trauma, violence done upon the child, sexual trauma, sexual abuse, and all forms of abuse, which lead to blame, shame, hurt, self-rejection, many psychological effects then will eventually lead for many into, well, first of all, into the same behaviors, like with addiction, to a substance of your choice. We look at behavior. Research has shown that when we look at behavior, if the abuser has a child, the child is abused, it therefore logically follows that the child may well, not always, I agree with you, you're probably saying, oh yeah, not all the time, hold on a minute, I agree. They can break that cycle, does not necessarily mean that the child will become an abuser too, but often it does. Or it may lead into other problems that have to do with addicting to a drug of choice because of what happened in childhood. Learning disorders, ADD, ADHD, attention span, hyperactivity. The attention span is this short. The child cannot sit still, and so on. Mental illness predating use. And quite often, as I've seen it in the inner city districts of Chicago, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and other places I've been to, other parts of the world I've been to, mental illness does often lead a person into an active state of trying to medicate what's not right in the mind, what's imbalanced in the brain. And quite often, when we deal with brain disorders, those who are schizophrenic, those who are dealing with, shall we say, paranoia, affective disorder, and as well as other disorders of the mind, they often think that, well, my medicines are not working, so I'll use alcohol or I'll use something else, a little more powerful, and I'll feel better and more functional. Not true. But mental illness does play a part. Also, too, depression, bipolar, psychosis, ADHD, those are just examples And so we need to be aware that mental illness quite often will lead that person to that feeling that they're out of control, but then going back to the issue of control, they need to feel like they are in control when they are out of control. It's kind of like the biker who my dad and I, and I may have used this story in the previous session, but we were at this diner at 11 o'clock at night, walked in, I was about 16 years old, 17, got breakfast, sat down, and this biker burst into the diner, and there was a table full of policemen not too far from the entrance having a break. And he says, "I was about to raise hell out there," he said, "till I saw you cops, you policemen." I thought, you know, there's something going on. And so as he walked in, had a seat, I walked by him to get a refill of coffee. Yes, I was into coffee as a teenager. I admit it. And came back, walking back with coffee, had a Jesus t-shirt on. I was really into my faith. And as the story goes, he looks up at my t-shirt and says, "I know Jesus. Yeah, he's my friend. Yeah." And then I walked, sat down and had more time with my dad, father-son time. And then about 1 minute later, not even, it felt like, that same guy comes to the booth, motions to me to move over and sat with us because he wanted to. Not because we invited him to, but because he wanted to. Had the whole thing, you know, leather jacket on, or actually leather vest, leather cap, bloodshot eyes, and we knew he was on some substance. And he began to talk about his travels and around the United States and Europe and other places, and on his mutt, he called it, a motorcycle that was made up of different parts of different brands. You motorcycle enthusiasts, you probably know what I'm talking about. And as he was talking about it, he just talked about his need for God, bottom line. Why? Because, as the story is applicable here, he was trying to say to us, "I am out of control. Because he saw my t-shirt with it had Jesus on it, and began to see that psychologically, therefore spiritually, he did not have it all together. Big surprise. So we look at the brain disease of addiction, but we also look at the spiritual side of addiction too. Of course, we've seen this before with the healthy brain and the cocaine, in this example, cocaine addict brain. The healthy brain, of course, you see the coloring that gives you the healthy brain. You see the lack of the coloring from the healthy brain to the sick brain. Prolonged use changes the brain in lasting ways. So with this biker guy, as he's sitting there in the booth with us, having coffee, talking about his story, you could also see, too, that in his mind, in his brain, he just could not completely function. It's very similar to how I've been working with another gentleman and his family, and how things just don't add up sometimes. Yet he's okay, he's functional, he's working full-time, and yet, things just don't add up sometimes. And there's always chaos because of the prolonged use of the substance of choice has changed the patterns of the brain and changed the thinking, changed the psychology of the person. No longer balanced, but imbalanced. More examples from the normal to the cocaine abuser. Of course, if you were in class with me now, I'd go over these questions as far as the three C's and the true or false. Addicts should only blame themselves for their addiction. They don't act responsibly. Could that be true or false? I'll let you decide. How drugs and alcohol work, of course, we looked at how they interact with the nerve circuits, the centers, the chemical messengers. I feel good, euphoria, and reward. Okay, now, this is getting into the psychology of what the drug and the substance does. So the psychology and the euphoria and the reward goes like this. I feel good, and the brain tells the person all over saying, yeah, this does feel good. I feel I'm in control. If you follow me. So I feel like I'm in control. I feel good. That feels like a reward. Kind of like at the end of a hard day at work, I go to the McDonald's drive-thru or go right into McDonald's and go to that place where you order and you get the two cheeseburgers, maybe four cheeseburgers. Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger. I got to have my cheeseburgers and my Coke and my sugar and my and the body says, oh yes, this feels good after. You deserve it. You deserve it. To make it yours today. You feel like you're in a commercial on television. And your body says, bring it on, because I couldn't stand the boss. That coworker, she's a nag, and I'm just not feeling right, and I'm not sure if I'm going to stay at this job. Oh, that was 8 hours of misery. I'm going to the 24-hour euphoria center. McDonald's. That's right. Or I'm going to go to the dope house where I can get my drug. Or I can go to the bar because that's where the good times roll. That's the psychology. It's like Dr. Skinner. How Dr. Skinner and B.F. Skinner is his name, how he examined the rats, the mice that he would then stimulate with this substance, that substance, and how every time you would hit the button or you would do one little trigger, because of that trigger, that mouse would then go back to the little spigot where they'll take the drink of whatever substance is out and it feels good, and so on and so forth. How then the mouse was then conditioned to come to that little spigot to take the drink. Just like Pavlov's dog, famous story. Ring the bell, the dog salivates, goes to the food, takes a drink of the water, to the point where the dog was so conditioned that you just ring the bell and the dog thinks it's hungry. The end of a hard work day. The saliva glands kick into gear and you deserve it. Self-indulge. No one will know. Especially your wife or your husband, your family, when you get back after you indulge at McDonald's or at the bar, you cover it up. Why? Because it's a reward. It makes the body feel better, makes you feel better in your thinking and your psyche, and you're feeling like, oh, I got, and therefore you understand. But I'm teasing this out of it because I want you to think about you and your experience, not someone else's. And a lot of this breaking the addiction cycle, this class, is not only to understand the social and psychological effects, but it's also to understand you as a Christian leader who's human, who's broken, but forgiven, washed clean. Ah, I feel good. I feel better. Again, reduces the negative feelings, so we think. Oh, the caffeine. Or this feels normal. This is a very important point. I feel normal now. I feel I'm on top of the world. I feel I'm functioning because I just had my 5 glasses of beer. If you remember the famous TV show Cheers, who comes in all the time and they say hi to him all unison in concert? Norm! Because Norm would come in, sit at the bar, and he would have one mug of beer and then have another mug of beer, and then 10 mugs later, he still wasn't finished. The body, so the character would tell us. The body could have more because it's tolerating more, it needs more. He feels normal. Get the joke? Normal. I feel normal. So the character of Norm felt in the TV show Cheers. So that this is how life is. How life ought to be. And again, I'm sure you've encountered people in their testimonies, I have as well, who, as they've come into recovery, saying, being in the dope house, being strung out on cocaine. A guy named Dave, who I'm working with right now, he says, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking when I was smoking cocaine in the dope house, and my wife didn't know where I was, and I thought that was normal. I thought that was life. Of course, he had marital problems. You can insinuate here, and he did. And why go back to that house where you have the negativity, when I could be here and be among friends and feel normal? And then, yes, the craving, tolerating the effects. But you say, boy, I can't go on like this. And with cocaine, and the stronger it gets, the more stress in the heart, and then the feeling like you're going to have a heart attack, as cocaine crack users have told me. Because that has not been my drug of choice. It's been their drug of choice, and they get to the point, again, where they do feel powerless, but they need more to feel normal, to not feel powerless. The insanity continues. And when they say, I can't do it, I must withdraw, abstain, they begin to withdraw, they feel sick, and they go into a detoxification center, or detox for short. Often they'll be there, they'll be shaking, they'll be sweating like crazy. The body is beginning to say, okay, you're not feeding me that substance to make me feel normal, therefore I'm going to now flush out of my system from the shakes, the sweating, the vomiting, to the other defecating, so that you are absolutely miserable. But it has to happen. If the person is to step out of that false sense of normalcy. And of course, here's some pictures of what happens in the brain. The dopamine spells reward. Ah, there's the release, the activation, the recycle, and it goes from there inside. The natural rewards. Ah, of course, look at food, sex, excitement, comfort. Pretty straightforward now that we've unpacked this. The pathways, the prefrontal cortex, nucleus accumbens, we've looked at this before, going right there into the pleasure centers, and then activation reward, different substances go in different directions. Cocaine, heroin, nicotine, into this place in the brain right here, alcohol over here, and heroin that way. Just does. That's not my area of expertise, but this is what we now know, what we learn from those who have studied this scientifically. My specialty is into the behaviors, working with people as they are actively using or they've detoxified and now they're in recovery. Here you have the behavior, the psychology, the need for control. First, a rewarding behavior becomes routine. Gotta have it. I feel good. I feel like me. So he or she thinks. 'Tis the subconscious control of the behavior. I can handle it. And then in the red here, it is hard to extinguish the behavior because you're realizing you're killing yourself. People are walking away from you. Psychologically, you're feeling alone and isolated. And not always aware when when it starts. The person resists change, becomes the habit, the way of life. Well, if those people are going to walk away, I'll find new friends. But you find friends who are just like you, who are in the same spiral, the same insanity status, and they will leave you too, eventually. Or they'll steal from you, or they'll kill you, eventually. Why? Because you're in that state of, I feel normal, I feel good, I need more drugs, I don't have money, I'll go steal the money. I'll steal the money so I can get my reward. So and the cycle continues. And eventually, you will then borrow money from people who are not trustworthy, and then they will get back at you violently and even to the point of threatening your life. And unfortunately, last week, a week ago today, actually, I led a memorial service for a young woman, 38 years old, who was at a party. She's been part of one of her families at community recovery for years, from when she was very, very young, and now a grown woman. Someone put something in her drink. She ingested it, began to not feel well, and was passing out. And then someone took a needle, shot her up with another drug, and she was becoming unresponsive, and they placed her in a bathtub to die. Fortunately, she was discovered, but it was too late. By the time they reached the hospital, she was pronounced dead on arrival. 38 years old, and I knew the young woman since she was a little girl. It's hard. But by God's grace, we work through the issues. The issues of, together as with that family, we're working through the issues of course, denial and how can this be, and bargaining, all the stages of grief, and just the intense pain of parents burying their children. Sobering. So psychologically, addiction leads to not only euphoria, a sense of reward, but also a deep sense of loss. Well, look at the dog with a bone example as we study this a little further. It never wants to let go that bone, that dog. It bugs you until it wants what it wants, until it gets what it wants. And for those of you who have dogs, I have a cat, so I can't relate as well, but I know enough people with dogs where they've said, yeah, it keeps on coming to me and, give me the bone. Oh, or the toy. Oh, I'm going to go outside. I want it now. Of course, it's funny when it comes to dogs, because dogs think you are God. As a cat person, the cat thinks she is God. So anyway, it's a funny story. So the dog keeps bugging you. It never forgets when and where it is used to getting its bone. It's always the same time of day. Always, again, that promise of reward. The threat of loss. Or the threat of punishment. Like the hard day at work. Oh, if I don't get my drink and my four cheeseburgers with everything on it and more sugar, I won't feel normal, so I can't tolerate the boss at the same time. I gotta have it. And the dog thinks it's going to get a bone anytime. They do anything that reminds it of the bone. Anytime. Ah, got to have it all the time. Well, how long does the brain remember? Look at the front of the brain, back of the brain, how things are activated. And the brain, things light up. But there are memory problems, short-term memory problems, short-term loss, which affects how we think, how we behave. Impaired abstraction. For example, a person can't process a math problem that's abstract if they're still in school. Or they can't process that question of, well, how do you love somebody? Concretely, they could say, well, I'm there. Yep, I got her coffee. I took her to the store. I love her. But what is love? And answering that abstract idea of love or life or worldview or these things that we learn here at Christian Leaders Institute, the brain becomes impaired, cannot process abstract thinking. And also preservation using failed problem-solving strategies. It's what we call the insanity button. I do different things as I hit that insanity button to get the same result. It's not working. Also, loss of impulse control. And this is pretty straightforward, pretty obvious. If I'm drinking too much alcohol, I should not be driving. And hence we have laws today about drinking and driving here in the United States. As well as the whole thing of cancer and other physical ailments that are caused by being addicted to nicotine, which is, of course, legal. And now you have cigarette companies that are being forced legally to put big signs on their labels and also at the store, smoking will kill you. That is Marlboro as one big example. As I've flown around the world and I've been to airports and I've gone to their duty-free shops, and the first time I saw it a few years ago, smoking kills. That was the big sign next to the Marlboro boxes of cigarettes that people could buy there in the airport. And yes, loss of impulse control. There's loss of control with in multiple ways, in ways we just discussed. I gotta have it. I gotta go through the drive-thru. I gotta go to the bar. I gotta. And that's what is controlling you now, and therefore there's no you having control over you. And as we looked at addiction in the first video, that goes back to idolatry. And also, just the fact that I can't work my hands the way I want to, or I can't think, have good recall when I want to, or whatever. The functions of the body start to break down sooner than later as we get older. They're similar to those with brain damage. Of course, what is it that makes addicted people like drugs and alcohol so much? Euphoria. Of course, alcohol is a common one. Related issues, of course, detoxification, fetal alcohol syndrome, loss of judgment. That's a big one too, especially when you're driving. Suicide, homicide. It hurts so bad. I got to drink more. DUI or DWI, driving with influence, driving under the influence. Polydrug use. Alcohol isn't enough. Give me cocaine. I wonder what this is going to be like if I put them together. Many people go there. Legality issues. You steal the money to get the drug. You will be incarcerated if you get caught. Commonly used or abused drugs, marijuana, of course. We call that a gateway drug. It's the gateway to other strong drugs. course, lack of motivation, arrested development, memory loss, long detection time, legalization issues. When it comes to marijuana, in terms of usage and legal, and now in many states, in the United States, marijuana is legal as far as having possession of it, but still what you do with it and how it impairs your mind and so on, like alcohol being illegal and so on, leading to problems in other areas. Health issues. Cocaine and crack, high relapse potential, high reward. Again, the cycle, euphoria to agitation to paranoia. They're always out to get me. Don't you know? Yeah. To the crash, to the sleeping, as well as not eating, euthymia, to craving, obsessive rituals, permanent paranoia, eventually, because the mind cannot handle it anymore. No medications are currently available to fight this. And also, increased risk to heart attack. Methamphetamine, high energy level, repetitive behavior patterns, incoherent thoughts and confusion, auditory hallucinations and paranoia, binge behavior, gotta have it, long acting with meth up to 12 hours. Strong. Heroin, detoxification issues, hard to get off of it. It's, as my friend had said, who he was the biggest, Nick Barbetta was his name. Nick said, he said to me in his book, Nick and Gretchen, if you can find it there on Amazon, I highly recommend it. It's his story. Nick Barbetta and his wife Gretchen were kind of like a Bonnie and Clyde of the drug world for a while. And they just did it all. And their main drug of choice was heroin. And as they trafficked heroin from Florida to the rest of the United States, and of course came from Central and South America, they were there in Miami to pick up the load, and they became the largest, they had the largest dealership and distribution at that time ever of heroin. And they were so hooked on it themselves, they describe it as being a demon, a devil. Something that was spiritually personified, controlling them and how they thought, behaved, what they did, what they said. It had to be about the drug. Intense withdrawal, physical pain, the craving, and so on. New drugs, club drugs, the mix, the match. Popular with youth and young adults, of course, it always is. Whatever's new, it's part of the youth culture, they say. And it's very true how it does come around, come through the young people. Neuron destruction with ecstasy. Users believe they know how to reduce the risk and the wrong. And the use has been increasing for Oxycontin and also ecstasy and, of course, now opioids. So common characteristics of people who are addicted, of course, unemployed or employed. We've talked about multiple or no criminal justice contacts. Difficulty coping with stress and anger. Another important point. Conflict, can't handle it. Paranoia, they're always out to get me. And they lash out. Or anger about family of origin again. And shame and blame. And they feel the shame still in their head. Even though maybe mom and dad have forgiven them years before, it's still there. Highly influenced by social peer group or loner. Isolation is common. Difficulty handling high-risk relapse situations or craves excitement. And we touched on that already about how you got to have it, got to do it now, like the dog and the bone. More common characteristics: emotional and psychological immaturity, difficulty relating to family, sustaining long-term relationships, of course, educational and vocational deficits, and violence. Alcohol, for example, disinhibits aggressivity, Stimulants produce dose-dependent paranoia. Opiate-seeking, but not opiates, produce violence because the brain thinks something's going on and it isn't. What are the risks of becoming addicted? Of course, at the genetics, the young age, learning disorders, mental illness. And of course, what are the first and second most craved substances? If you look back here in this presentation, what are the first, second, and third most used substances? And, of course, true or false. Addicted people are usually homeless, criminal, antisocial, and older than 26. Now, I'm going to jump in here and give you that answer. That's false. Addiction and how it affects people is no respecter of persons, class, or anything. It affects all ages, all situations, all status. That is reality. There are also co-occurring disorders. Each disorder affects the other and changes the outcome of treatment. And now we look at our second case study, a 25-year-old single woman pregnant with one child. She has a GED, which is the equivalent of a high school diploma, wants to go to community college, opiate, nicotine, alcohol dependent, depression and anxiety since age 20, one suicidal attempt, multiple intense and brief relationships, CWS, or that's coming from this material, it's from another place, but it's also, we call it child family services here, and where the government gets involved with the family and takes the kids away due to neglect. Close to parents and no female friends. On the multiaxial diagnosis, we look at, and if we just look back, if we look back at this, at the case, at the 25-year-old woman, think about the dog in the bone. Think about the insanity button. Think about how, like with Pavlov's dog, she needed it so bad. Psychologically, she was disconnected from her kid. And she's becoming she was neglectful of other things in her life. Nothing mattered anymore but the drug. And that's where people finally said, "I can't deal with you anymore." And so we look at, then, these diagnoses. We look at clinical disorders, like, of course, antisocial disorder, also bipolar disorder, and other disorders. Also personality disorders with mental retardation, medical conditions, psychosocial factors, global assessment of functioning. In other words, how does the whole person function? How is the choice of drug impacted this person? Now, this is a bit dated, we look at 04, but the question is, if teens abuse specific substances, what's their risk of having mental health problems? Here, if you can tell, we have green, we also have blue and red. Low risk, 0 to 4 problems. Medium risk, in the blue, 5 to 10 problems. Red, high risk, 11 to 22 problems. So with the total admits, fortunately we have low risk being higher than the other two, but as you can see, you have the medium and high at pretty decent levels. Marijuana, thankfully, low risk is higher. Alcohol, the low risk is higher. But when it comes to alcohol and marijuana, medium risk is higher. Prevention of all of these things, low risk is higher. Maybe different today. Studies are still being done to keep up on the latest. And of course, if teens abuse cocaine, what's the risk of having mental health problems? Well, cocaine is different than alcohol and marijuana, based on this study. High risk, and this is probably representative, even though it's 15 years old, looking around you, and of course looking at probably more recent studies and so forth, as they're coming hot off the press, as we say, is probably going to be representative. So the high risk with cocaine total is higher, and the others are broken down, and we do have issues. 15 is the abused opiates. What's their risk of having mental health problems? High risk. High risk. Why do we need to do more to help people with co-occurring disorders? More treatment? More relapse? More rehospitalization? More ER visits? More vulnerability? More violence? More suicide? More homelessness? More arrests? Why do we need to do more to help people with co-occurring disorders? Because one drug of choice is not always the issue. Quite often, with each person, something else is going on. Mentally, psychologically, and also, therefore, socially, globally. As well as more illness and earlier death. And also resistance to treatment. And as I said before, in this class, the church is the hope of the world. The church needs to be there. The church has to step up as God's community, God's people, and get involved with people who deal with disorders that are acute. But of course, as we all have something, we need to get real and also begin to not stigmatize, to destigmatize addiction of all forms. Now you have more understanding of the nature of addiction, psychology, the mind as it relates to behavior, and also choices. From here, we're going to get into the economic and other areas of addiction as we look at breaking the addiction cycle in this class. Thanks for watching.